Hi everyone, it's Adam from Monkey Tennis here. Just saying a huge thank you to all of you that have supported my charity appeal so far. For those that haven't heard about it, this September I'm going to be swimming 15 kilometres between five islands in Cornwall. I'll be swimming the Isles of Scilly, that's Scilly, S-C-I-L-L-Y. I'm doing it because I want to, but also to raise money for CALM, the campaign against living miserably. It's a well-known statistic that 125 people in the UK die by suicide every week, and CALM run a free and confidential helpline for people to speak through their problems and ultimately to help prevent suicides. I'm looking to raise enough money to train two new phone workers to man those lines, and I'll be doing it by swimming the Isles of Scilly in Cornwall. If you're looking to support me, it would be greatly appreciated. You can donate at justgiving.com. Just go there and search for Adam Swim Scilly. That's Adam Swim Scilly, S-C-I-L-L-Y. All donations greatly appreciated. Thank you for helping me to support CALM. And now, on with Monkey Tennis.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Monkey Tennis?
Smelly Alan Fartridge?
Linton Travel Tavern seemed an obvious choice.
Monkey Tennis?
At the BBC of all places. Be real.
Monkey Tennis?
Where's my assistant? I do not know.
Monkey Tennis?
I wish things had turned out differently, but I'm glad they didn't.
Monkey Tennis?
It will be called Alan's Show. I decided, and would be absolutely ace.
Monkey Tennis?
But needless to say, I had the last laugh.
Hello, Alan fans, and welcome to Monkey Tennis, the Alan Partridge fan podcast. I'm Adam Brooks, and I'm joined by Tom Dark.
The noise fizzed out of my back passage like a child calling for help.
Nick Older.
Smelly Alan Fartridge.
And Tom Stab.
Still French kissing eight-year-olds.
So as you may have guessed from that introduction, we are starting this week with I, Partridge. We need to talk about Alan. Alan's technically first book, although Bouncing Back exists and doesn't exist.
Again, it depends what universe you're in there. Yeah. That's it,
yeah. Which so timeline.
The way we're tackling this book is that we've all studied I, Partridge in full. We've looked at both the physical book and the audio book, as there are some key differences. And each of us is going to take a phase of Alan's life as covered in I, Partridge, starting this week with Nick covering the early years. It's worth us mentioning that you should definitely read and or listen to I, Partridge first, because these forthcoming episodes are going to be packed with spoilers. And also, the book has a mandatory soundtrack. Alan says it's essential that you listen to this. So Tom Dark is our resident soundtrack expert.
So as we go through chapter by chapter, I'll be letting you know what songs you need to be listening to get the full Partridge experience.
So before we get into the first set of chapters, it's worth talking a little bit about the wider context of this book. Tom Stab has some key intel, as he actually used to work at the company that released it.
Yeah, so the book was published by HarperCollins in 2011. I was working there at the time. I didn't work on this specific publication, but I was working in a different department. But I have been able to pull some key information in terms of sales figures.
Excellent news.
So do we want to go around the table and speculate on how many copies we think this is sold? Bear in mind that I have it broken down by hardback and paperback, so I can give you a total, but I can give you the individual breakdowns
as
well.
As a publishing expert, can you give us some idea of what it takes for, say, a book to get to a number one or a number 10 spot? Like, what's what what are sales like?
No, I can't.
Okay. Well, the best
publishing expert.
But
Tom
you are
Stab
a publishing
there.
Expert.
Yeah, absolutely.
The best I've got is I looked at the Sunday Times bestsellers list a couple of weeks ago, and it looked like first week sales to get to the number one spot of fiction was about 4,000 copies, which seemed remarkably low to me. Do you have intel on what time of year it was released? Was it Christmas?
I think
it was
a Christmas.
Yeah, it was definitely Christmas.
Bound to be.
It would have been. It would have been one of the big releases. We used to go and do the equivalent of like cinema studios when they do slate presentations about what's coming, and yeah, this would have been a big priority for Q4.
Numero one.
Very good.
Well, I'm happy to take a punt first. Go on, then. I literally have.
Do we want to do total, or do you want to do the individual?
Total.
Let's keep it one number. Total across hardback and paperback.
Okay, I'm going to say. Oh God, I'm going to say that it's done 64,000 copies
across both.
Across both.
Okay.
I think that's very conservative. I will go for 530,000.
Okay.
Ooh, I think that's quite high.
Yep.
Ooh,
I am wildly speculating. Okay. I've got no idea.
I'm going to go for 289.
289. Okay. Well, I have the figures here.
I mean, hang on. Producer Jed could have a guess.
Oh, yeah. You could. Yeah, one word. Yeah.
Would you like to guess with your one word, Jed?
700,000.
700,000 from Jed. Jed is the highest. Okay. So I have the numbers.
Some people would
say
700,000 is actually three words, Jed.
Get out.
We'll let it go.
So I got these figures. It's mid-August 2017 now. So these are numbers pretty up to date. So on hardback, it's done 158,435 copies. Mm-hmm. Paperback, 81,641 copies. So in total, that's 240,076 copies across both formats.
So okay. Nick's the closest, right?
He is, yeah.
Yay!
Oh, Nick wins that one.
That's annoying.
Bookworm.
So before we delve into the book on a chapter-by-chapter review, as it were, it's worth mentioning how brilliant the actual physical book itself is. The cover is amazing. You've got Alan with a horrendously bronzed fake tan face, and I love the fact you can see how pale his hand is in comparison for skin colour, and that's very much like how he appeared when he was on TFI Friday and Jonathan Ross and things like that. So that's like the new perma faked hand Partridge.
A huge amount of gold embossing as well, which is what you'd imagine Alan would insist on.
Insisted.
It's a little bit like when we were talking about Scissored Isle, that you can see the decisions that Alan would make reflected in the book cover, can't
well,
you?
Well, that's an embossed cover, so from a production point of view, that is quite quite an expensive little book cover he's got there on Alan's insistence, of course.
Yeah, yeah.
Also, I have a confession to make. And before we started recording, Nick pointed out that the tan difference between the face and the hand, I hadn't actually noticed.
No, me neither.
That's the joke.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And on the back, you've got two review quotes on the back.
Glowing endorsements.
Yeah. Man of the Moment from TV Quick magazine in 1994. Yep. And he makes several references to that throughout the book. That's basically the only glowing endorsement he's got.
He also makes reference to that back in Knowing Me, Knowing You when he first receives that quote.
And then also, very thorough from the Norwich Inquirer.
You would think he'd be able to get the Norwich Inquirer to say something more positive than just very thorough, wouldn't you, at least?
And then also, there is... I only noticed this the other day. On the what would you call that, like the inside jacket sleeve.
Yeah.
There so you've got the credits for the photo, so it says photo Adam Lawrence, photoshopping Alan Partridge. And then has an asterisk, and the asterisk leads to enhancements only made where absolutely necessary: forehead, eyes, brackets, bags, creases, jowl, brackets, left and right, blood vessels, brackets, random, and nose, brackets, tip, septum, and gullies.
There's something so about everything. Tip, septum, and gullies that is, it sounds like the worst lawyers in the world.
Bear in mind, we're obviously talking, this is the hardback we're describing here. There's obviously the paperback version as well. We haven't got a copy of that here, but I'm just going to hold it up to the screen, hold the screen up to
that's
my
good.
Colleagues here.
Yeah, so it's a different picture.
Quote-wise, arguably less funny because it is a genuine...
The quote on the back is brilliantly witty from the Times. And if you open up the book, so it's laying flat, it's a sort of image of Alan lying down in what can only be described as sort of...
like a safari outfit,
yeah. And he's kind of like kneeling his elbow on the ground and resting his head on it, looking very...
I mean, that get-up kind of matches quite well with Nomad, really, doesn't it?
Mm. Yeah, it does, actually. Yeah. And then it's also got on there the Sunday Times bestseller.
Mm, so, by this point, it is a bestseller, fact. So it's obviously written by Rob Gibbons, Neil Gibbons, Armando Iannucci, and Steve Coogan. This is the the biggest team, I guess, of people contributing still think to an Alan project?
Well, I still think it's one of those things that in reality, it probably is Rob and Neil who have done the majority of the writing. The others are purely there just to sign off on. And
I don't think that's the case because...
Do you not think? That's what I assume the setup is.
No, I think these... Iannucci and Coogan have such vested interest in these characters. I reckon they would have been heavily involved in this. It would have been akin to a writer's room, I reckon.
I'm not suggesting they're not involved. I'm just saying I don't think they're doing the writing. They're just saying, I like that, I don't like that, maybe think about this.
Another thing of note is the dedication for this book. He's dedicated it for Fernando, full stop, and Denise. so much meaning in this sentence.
Yeah.
Firstly, obviously, Denise, as always with Alan, is very much second place.
Yeah, she's an afterthought.
Yes, maybe a child. Yeah. The fact that it could have just been for Fernando and Denise, but there's a full stop after Fernando as if to put her down an extra level. And obviously, it's just bad grammar to start a sentence with and. So he's managed to mess up so many things and he's not even started the book yet.
And to slightly jump ahead, isn't there a bit where he goes, and I also have a daughter, and there's an asterisk in the footnote. It just says Denise.
Yeah.
To be fair, I mean, we can come into it in a bit more detail, but Denise and Fernando are barely referenced in the book. They're kind of covered off fairly quickly and then that's it.
I mean, to be honest, I think for him to say more about them, he would have to have some sort of regular contact, which, we'll realise, is probably not
fair enough. Yeah.
And with that, let's pass over to Nick as we move into Alan's early years, chapters 1-8.
Starting at the beginning, chapter 1 is simply entitled Beginnings.
Yeah, although if you've listened to the audiobook version, chapter 1 is actually three separate chapters in the audiobook. So the audiobook version, chapter 1 is Nosebleeds, followed by Family Life, followed by Divorce.
So how...
the big three. Tells you where we're going, doesn't
it? Yeah, exactly.
It's starting well.
Has everyone read it? Because I only listened to the audiobook.
I've listened and read.
Yeah, I've listened and read.
Listened and read.
Where did you get a copy of the book from?
Just a book from HarperCollins when I worked there.
Oh. Okay. For clarity, I didn't have a copy of the book and was not able to source one from any of the shops
in the last 6 months since we decided to do
this. Exactly.
Just get it on Kindle, mate. It's about £2.
Yeah.
So a theme that kind of comes up a lot through the early chapters is one of bullying. And it seems like it's fair to suggest that this has shaped the character that Alan comes on to be.
It comes it comes back a lot later in Partridge canon as well, doesn't it, about the chalk penis on his back, and also him saying to Lynn in the film, you know, what do you do with bullies, Lynn? You make friends with them so you can bully someone else, or words to that effect.
Yeah. That's what I like about this early part of the book, is that obviously there's a lot of this book which we kind of know what happens to Alan, you know, the TV years, the radio years, etc. But this gives a lot of context outside of him, or certainly the Alan that we know. So we, you know, this is a whole section of Alan's life that we have no idea what happened. So by doing this, they've given quite a bit of context to how he develops as a person and as a character, and it kind of explains quite a lot about his.
He makes more sense. Definitely.
And I think that's they've in terms of, you know, the writing, they've done that very, very well to, you know, to make Alan more rounded and to understand him a little bit more. I think, not getting too
you kind of have a small amount of sympathy with some of the stories that he kind of tells. So
I agree with that.
He talks about kind of school bullies tying him to the roundabout to induce a nosebleed, although it's also worth flagging that there are several other things that also induce a nosebleed with Alan. Those include physical exercise, spicy food, brightness or sunlight.
I think he might have meningitis. Yeah. You know?
Embarrassment, dairy, shouting, hearing or doing, or fiddling with his nose. That's quite an extensive
list.
That's
pretty much the entire spectrum of human endeavour, isn't it? There's not.
Has anyone ever had a nosebleed from eating spicy food?
No.
I can't remember the last time I had
a curry that was so spicy it made me sneeze. That's about the closest I can get to that.
Yeah. And kind of, I don't know if anyone noticed this, but Alan did make reference to, if this was a kind of a modern day, he might return back to his schools to sort of do away with his school bullies with Uzis, which I kind of thought was something that you'd expect maybe Michael to say, maybe something that Alan would be saying.
Can I touch briefly on this very pivotal tree that comes up in...
Absolutely.
So he basically posts first nosebleed, he runs off and finds himself directly under a tree. And he says, "Why?" I thought, "Why this tree? What is it about this simple field maple that makes it stand out from the others? It's not the biggest, the strongest, the coolest, the best at PE." kind of thinking he's projecting a little, but it is worth mentioning that he sets this tree up as being a sort of important plot device in his own life, because it will come back later in the book.
Well, I can share a bit of insight about this from the Coogan autobiography. So this tree story is kind of based on something real in Coogan's life. I'll read a bit here. So he writes in his autobiography, "There's a story we use in iPartridge that is true. On 31st of December 1979, I went and sat alone on a bench under a tree in Alcrington Woods across the road from my parents' house. I thought to myself, this is the last day of the 70s. No one will remember this decade. Nothing defines it. What a shame I'm not sitting here at the end of the 1960s instead."
Wow.
And then he goes on to write, he was 14 and he remembers the decade vividly. I'll skip along a little bit. Then he writes, on the 31st of December 1989, he basically went and did the same thing. So having a bit of a reminisce about the decade that's passed before.
Interesting. Did he say the 80s was rubbish as well?
He doesn't really go into that. He says, I was sat there on my own thinking, it's been 10 years since I last sat on this bench. What I've been doing? Wow, I went to drama school and now I do voices for Spitting Image and I do comedy on stage and I earn a living. 10 years after that, he writes, he was in Devon getting drunk with Simon Pegg, celebrating the new millennium. We had a jolly night, but there was a nagging feeling that I should have been under that tree.
That's such a Partridge thing to say.
So that was the 1999 one. Then in 2009, he went back to the bench, taking his daughter Claire, who was 13, and told her he used to sit there on his own and contemplate the end of a decade. And she just replied with, that's interesting. And then basically Coogan writes, he told Neil and Rob Gibbons about this bench experience, and they said, that's hilarious, we'll use it in the Partridge book.
Brilliant. He's probably done this meaningful, significant thing that he does every 10 years. Yeah, he's like, that's hilarious.
That's comedy gold, Steve, thanks.
That's Alan through and through.
Well, the way that, so he kind of describes this, this tree as kind of having a certain something at ease with itself, a gentle authority, it had class and spunk. I kind of thought, does a tree really have spunk? But maybe it's not worth delving into that. And then there's this kind of this technique that is kind of peppered throughout the whole of the book, to be honest. So Alan says, then it hit me. And then there's a pause and he just goes, the thought. And there's loads of instances where he kind of uses that technique where I guess Alan feels a need to clarify that it wasn't the tree that hit him.
Speaking of literary devices that you find used and misused throughout the book, this chapter has the first instances of the pitter-patter, which he massively overuses through the whole of iPartridge.
So Alan goes on to tell the story about the night that he's born. It's there's a storm brewing outside. Anthony Eden is about to be named Prime Minister. I'd never heard of Anthony Eden as well, in terms of like historical figures. I'd never heard that name before. Yeah,
he's about to be named Prime Minister.
Is that is that partly the joke though? That's
absolutely the joke.
It's not really. He wasn't a seminal, newsworthy Prime Minister as such, but
yeah, and the fact the way he teased that up. Looks like Anthony Eden's about to be named Prime Minister, mutters a nurse as she strolls past the door.
I also like
that. He's really trying to set the scene, but he doesn't know how to do it just really making it cringy.
And he obviously wasn't really there to take notes, so he's got incredibly inaccurate phrases, like the midwife saying, her contraptions are massive.
Yes.
I mean, A, it's contractions, and B, you wouldn't say massive, would you?
Followed by get ready. Like he's going to be fired out.
And I like the bit where it's Chelsea are about to win the first division title.
Please do an impression of the voice.
Chelsea are about to win the first division title.
That bit is well worth listening to in the audio book.
Yep. And he says, almost certainly not educated enough to follow politics. I did double check. Chelsea did win the first division title in 1955.
We hear of Alan's mum for the first time, a Dorothy Partridge.
As he slithers from her legs.
Yeah, and it's kind of like Alan kind of benchmarks himself against like all the other babies. So one, he talks about how his baby gurgles are like the most developed out of all the babies on the ward. And it's just like, one, he kind of feels the need to benchmark himself against other babies. And two, there's obviously no proof as to whether that was true or not. And one, you know, it's impossible to define whether a gurgle is good or not.
But I think there's a lot of things that happen in this book that are impossible to prove. Yeah. But Alan presents them as fact.
This is the first establishing of how much artistic license Alan's going to take when describing his own life. life.
He's an unreliable narrator, despite this book being about him by him.
Oh yeah, yeah, that and that's a massive overriding thing with the whole book, the unreliable narrator part, which is where a lot of the gags lie. Yeah,
the only part of this I would say is reliable is when he says that the proud wail burst from his lungs and it was his first broadcast delivered to an audience of no more than 8 that still equated to an audience share in the delivery room of a cool 100%. Yep. I'm sure that's true. I'm sure everyone in the delivery room heard him cry.
Also, the next line, not bad, I probably thought. Not bad at all. He uses that quite a lot as well.
So we obviously kind of find out that Alan is essentially an only child. And I think that it's kind of unsurprising in many respects, because I think he kind of sums up a bit of an only... some of the problems of being an only child, although you're obviously an only child. Stab, I'm not drawing any comparisons.
You're saying I'm like Alan Partridge?
No. And to be fair, Alan does speculate as to why he might be an only child. Perhaps he bust his mum's cervix.
I thought you could say perhaps can we speculate on why you're an only child?
No. Or maybe your dad just perfected the withdrawal technique.
Christ, let's say that for a different podcast.
I'm glad we've drawn this parallel.
Yeah, sorry, brilliant. Dad. He does listen.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Also,
maybe tell him to skip this episode.
Yeah, at an early age, Alan kind of develops a motto for himself, which I kind of made a note of because I thought it kind of summed up Alan sort of perfectly. So it said, "I didn't have a motto growing up, but if I did, it would be, I'd love some friends, please." Although perhaps in Latin.
That actually ties quite nicely to a bit of Scissored Isle when he's visiting the manor and he so desperately wants to be in with the guy who owns the manor. He's like, "Oh, thank you so much for sharing your time with me. Oh, it's been so nice to hang out together." He just wants rich friends, really, doesn't he?
Yeah, absolutely. He
he wants to climb socially, doesn't he, in a big way.
So Alan talks about one of the guys that he went to school with, a chap called Graham Rigg, who apparently had perfected intersex handshakes.
That important first step.
Absolutely, and cheek pecks. He was too cool to go to school, although apparently definitely did attend. And Alan basically bumps into him years down the line in a home base and insinuates that he's still kissing 8-year-olds. But
yeah, I love that bit.
Pointing an accusing finger at his potentially paedophilic mouth. You know that HarperCollins made him put the word potentially in that sentence, don't you?
Alan talks a lot as well about being neglected as a child. I kind of wanted to ask, like, do you feel that this is kind of true? Because he talks about Papa.
I thought you were
going to
ask whether we felt neglected as children.
No, because he says, like, he talks about Papa having a hand like a leather shovel, which obviously just suggests that Alan was literally beaten as a child. But I wonder if there's a kind of another side to this story. That
well, I think the truth behind it is that in the Alan universe, of course, that he had a totally happy and fulfilled upbringing, and he's just milking the kind of trend for misery lit. So he's creating this hard upbringing because he thinks that's what readers want.
Absolutely. I don't think there's even another side of the story. I don't think there's one side in the first place. I think he's just, he's mining maximum misery out of what is basically a couple of teenage or young youth scuffles.
Yeah, because isn't it things like his dad getting him to clean out the garage and stuff?
Yeah.
But he's making out like he was basically imprisoned as a slave.
That's that's basically the clue, isn't it? Yeah. That what yeah. is going on is actually...
Yeah, I mean, we mentioned it childhood. Already, but unreliable narrator yes. is the key literary phrase for this whole book.
Perhaps a telling sentence to that effect is he says that mine was a childhood of undeniable hardship. Undeniable.
yeah.
A chilling and far from delicious cocktail of neglect, solitude, domestic strife and abuse. I was, if you like, a child called it. This was Alan's Ashes. A protagonist dealt a really shoddy hand by hard-hearted parents. He then says in brackets, this is the best bit, they're dead now and my mum's sister Valerie, who disputes my version of events pretty vociferously, has gone medically demented and so I'm really the gospel here. I think that tells you everything you need to know.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
And with that Alan's Ashes, that's obviously referencing Angela's Ashes. Yep. So again, he's referencing the exact type of book that he's trying to replicate.
Yeah, and people have he does kind of confess and says that people have said that he's embellishing his childhood because it would be boring and that the publishers wanted it to sound more interesting than perhaps it was, and that he's potentially playing it down.
Anything that he describes that could even remotely be construed as abuse is basically undermined by a footnote. So he says his dad said to him, "You'll never amount to anything. You're that to me." On the word that, he held his finger and thumb, one maybe 2 centimetres apart, as if to say, not very much. But then there's a footnote to that that says, Auntie Valerie, who was there that day, is adamant that dad said absolutely nothing of the sort. But like I say, this is a woman who often forgets her own address, so you can strike her testimony from the record.
And actually, you know, Mr. Partridge is a bit of a good egg. He went and fought in World War II. He signed up on his 17th birthday. He says, "I'm off to save a Jew or two." I enjoyed that line.
So Alan's parents as well, sadly, their marriage ends with a divorce. And Alan says that it was rare to see a divorce 50 years ago, as rare as it was to see a four-leaf clover or a black chap in a position of authority.
Right, which, so I have a question here. This is kind of alluding...
Well, Alan, I just want to kind of qualify that as well, yeah. because obviously I've just kind of said that, which is pretty bad. And he goes on to say, if only things had stayed that way, I mean about the divorce.
Yeah, so he just has to quantify that. And the other thing is that, you know, we've always kind of questioned, is Alan racist or is he just, you know, ignorant? There's a bit in here, he said, "The closest I ever got to the extermination of the Jews was teasing John Malik about his big nose. But A, I didn't even know he was Jewish. B, it was pretty massive. You could have hung your washing off it. They say your nose is one of the few things that keeps growing throughout your life. John will now be 56. Good God." Which is a brilliant, brilliant quote. But it's like, I think Alan is kind of, he a bit too close to the bone here at some points, isn't he?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. He doesn't have any ounce of tact or subtlety.
I'm surprised you let that through when you were at HarperCollins, to be honest.
I was going to say, if you've got a potential editor in this timeline, this universe, putting words like potentially in and allegedly, I don't think that would get through the note.
Okay, so that concludes the first chapter. So moving on to Scouts and Schooling, I would say essentially it is more of the same, but we can come to that. But first, let's go to Tom to find out what the track listing is for this chapter.
Thanks, Nick. The soundtrack you will need to listen to for chapter 2 is Anything by Keane and Small Town Boy by Bronski Beat.
So we're on the second chapter and he's already given up on picking specific tracks. Yeah,
anything.
His enthusiasm for this playlist is not what I thought it would be.
And it's probably worth explaining for those that haven't read the book. There are many, many footnotes in the book containing extra gags. So he places footnotes to tell you when to listen to the tracks. So they are actually synced up with very specific parts of the narrative.
Very clever.
Question to the group. Were any of us scouts around the table?
Yep.
Yes, I was.
Yeah. Beaver Cub and Scout here.
Senior sixer, mate.
Yep.
Big in the game.
Senior sixer. They tried to keep me on after the age that you're supposed to leave as well.
Van Wilder of the Scouts.
Basically, Van Wilder Scout liaison. Yeah.
Would not watch.
Yeah, absolutely not.
I was just a beaver and a cub, tapped out at Scouts.
Well, in terms of Alan and his history with Scouts, this might shock you, but apparently he was brilliant in the Scouts, although he does have to qualify that again by saying in the North Norwich district, although I reckon he was probably pretty confident that he was good on a national level. Although, to be fair, he does flag one weakness. He can't do fire, and that's why he still opts for a gas barbecue. Although I would have had him
lovely
down
detail.
As... I'd have had him down as a proper barbecue man. I think a gas barbecue is a bit of a cheat.
I think he probably likes the theatre of a barbecue, but doesn't want to actually necessarily go through the rigmarole of having to actually rely on setting fire.
Too much like manual labour for him.
Exactly.
I reckon probably his love of scouting is more the rules and organisation, and most
Absolutely.
Importantly, the hierarchy, as I guess we'll come on to.
Yeah.
But when it comes to actually doing the orienteering, the hill climbing, the log collecting that forms part of scouting, I don't think he... I think he probably sees that as work beneath him.
Yeah, oh, definitely.
Sadly, life at the Scouts wasn't all good. So as with the previous chapter, there is another instance of bullying, this time with a chap called Phil Wiley, who steals his trunks and puts them in a urinal. So again, just more evidence that Alan kind of doesn't get on with the other boys and kind of suffers at the hands of bullies.
Although he is kind of asking for it in this scenario, I think.
Yeah, his behaviour towards me as superior officer was quite shameful, yeah. So says Alan.
Well, no, I get that point, like, Phil Wiley has behaved badly, but I think Alan taking his position so seriously is just going to set himself up to be...
Oh, absolutely.
I say.
And actually, it's quite interesting. We're talking about he's embellished his hard upbringing with regards to his parents, but I think the bullying is all very real and legitimate.
Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah. He could have just made more of that instead. Yeah.
Yeah. He still holds a grudge against Wiley, who he describes as a bit of an underachiever who got a lab technician pregnant. But I kind of thought, well, that seems a bit unfair. We don't know that makes him an underachiever. He's allowed to have sex with someone and get them pregnant, right?
Oh, yeah, but in Alan's world.
So is this is Dave who becomes the teacher at the school in I'm Alan Partridge, yeah, gets the lab assistant pregnant.
I'm not sure if it's the same.
I don't think it's the same.
Well, how many people are there out there having sex with lab technicians and never
more
seeing
than
the
kids? Realize, Adam, more than you would realise, Adam.
Because he does say he drifted into a spiral of underachievement, culminating in his having sex with a lab technician. Because of pregnancy, she gave birth to a child, as you do. Although Wiley has as close a relationship with it as you or I do, which is a very good payoff. And that's what made me think it was the same guy that's in I, Man and Partridge, because he gets the lab technician pregnant and he never sees the kid.
Ah, possibly.
And we've just cross-referenced it with I, Man and Partridge. And yes, that is... Phil Wiley, the teacher who gets the lab assistant pregnant and doesn't see the kid.
There we go.
Bloody
makes
knew
sense,
it.
Doesn't it? Yep.
Yeah. Well done. So Alan consistently references his lack of love and affection and talks about a time that he had to go and move in with his guardian angels, his words, who came in the form of the Lambert family, which he says he's forever in their debt, although not in any legal sense, important to note, who he went to live with for 3 weeks, which he very much kind of positions as he kind of, you know, ran away to go and live with them. But actually the reality is his parents were on a 3 week holiday in Brittany and just left him.
Yeah, I love the phrasing here. Returning home only because mum and dad had come back from the Highland in Brittany and it was time to go.
Yeah. There's a lovely touch as well in terms of him giving information that's completely unnecessary, where he says the children were marginally older than I was and remain so to this day, which remind me very much, if anyone saw that viral clip of when there was a report about a lion being shot and it said like and Cecil the lion's brother, who is also a lion.
Oh yeah. And Alan doing things like that, is that just to add to the word count as well? Quite possibly.
Yeah, probably. Yeah.
But anyone who says that is really, 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 really.
Exactly.
I love that. So Alan bursts into tears when he's kind of taken home, and he describes the Lamberts as very much crying, although inwardly, when Alan leaves, which is basically they were just waving him goodbye and probably got on with their lives.
But it's fine. He can stay with them anytime he likes.
And that's crucial.
Remember that, everyone.
Remember Lambert says, "Come," a sentence that he will come to regret so deeply. Come and stay anytime you like.
So it's at this point that we cover the smelly Alan Partridge. More instances of Alan being bullied. So to give the song its full lyrics, it goes, "Smelly Alan Partridge, he lives with his mum. He lives in her bum. You think that's bad? You should smell his dad." I mean,
savage. Savage.
Brutal. Great playground banter.
Fun fact, I once tried to start a DJ set with a clip of this Smelly Alan Partridge and it went down like a sack of shit.
What's good about this is that it's going to really resonate with the people of that sort of age group. It's got keywords. It's got keywords in there. Fart, bum. It's easy to remember. It's a good rhyme.
Yeah. I think it's solid.
Yeah. The mum bum, bad dad. Yeah. It's a classic rhyming scheme for prepubescence.
So obviously the bullying about him being smelly, as we've talked about on a few episodes previously, that's really stuck with him. So we've always said that he has an obsession with cleanliness. So there's a very telling quote that follows this. "I did not smell. I was a keen cleanser, diligently showering each day and making sure that my body, privates, face and mouth were stench and stain free. If I smelt of anything, it would have been matey," brackets now Radox and Colgate.
It's Stephen McComb, isn't it, who is the culprit here, calling him Smelly Alan Partridge. He comes up a lot.
It's Stephen McComb is mentioned as the primary bully throughout all the TV shows as well. Yeah.
Do you think as well that basically the naming of him as Smelly Alan Partridge is what leads him in later years to need a shower before and ideally after sex with Sonia?
Yeah.
And let's not forget that McComb was, and I'm sure is, a grade A Dumbo.
Not your words, the words of Alan Partridge. And he follows that with, "He could afford to lock around in class, so certain was his fate as a manual worker.
I love that.
And later on, Makuma had left school at the first opportunity, his mindless decision-making conducted almost entirely by a hormone-addled penis, desperate to impregnate the first chubby cashier it could slip into.
Sure enough, section is brilliant.
Sure enough, Makuma and Janice have a litter of four children, not much younger than they are. Way to go, guys.
And he kind of reveals he's essentially been stalking him because he says, well, is there something about the garden? Yeah, the divergence between our two lives, best illustrated in our choice of garden furnishing. I've enhanced my lawn with a rockery. Makuma has a broken washing machine.
And also, he keeps ringing him up and sort of talking to him on the phone, like pretending to be someone else, like threatening him almost. So he's kind of pretty much stalking Makuma.
Yeah. I did have, before we move on to the next chapter, I did have one note as well, which is quite important, I thought. This, at this point, towards the end of this chapter, is the first I had the last laugh mention. Mm-hmm. And I think there are actually only two mentions of having the last laugh in this whole book, which I was quite disappointed by. Yep. And it's also, I think, the first time in the book he mentions being named TV Quick's man at the moment in 1994.
There's also a few jump forwards here as well. He says examples of when the smelly Alan Fartridge barbs have stood him in good stead. One is when Bridie McMahon, failed TV presenter
Bridie who you McMahon. Won't have heard
of, pointed out on air, obviously in Knowing Me, Knowing You, that an anagram of anal? Alan Partridge is anal dirge prat.
You're thinking of anal chloride, the anagram for Nick.
Sure, I wanted to shove her in the face, but had the self-discipline not to. I also like that a formerly significant TV critic Victor Lewis Smith described his military-based quiz show Skirmish as a thick man's Takeshi's castle. Very nice.
So that takes us to the end of the chapter. So next up is East Anglia Polytechnic. Throwing to you, Tom Dark, to give us an update on the track listings.
Your mandatory soundtrack for this chapter is Thank God I'm a Country Boy by John Denver.
Nice. So this kind of opens with Alan getting the results of his A-levels. But I think it's important to note that whenever he kind of impersonates anyone else and kind of and uses kind of a different voice, he always kind of makes him sound like a bit of a moron. So here you get an impression of his mum going, open it. He sounds like she's really struggling to speak.
And this is where it really pays off to listen to the audiobook as well.
The following sentence is completely unnecessary as well when he's like, yes, open it, said Dad, frightened, in the same voice as his mum.
Yeah. So Alan uses a technique that's seen on The X Factor. So your son has failed at failing his exams. Very much forward thinking, although he's probably retrofitted that into the story. I'm sure it didn't happen at the time. Apparently his mum pats him and his dad gives him one of the first high fives in that Norwich had ever seen. Not sure if that's true.
Unlikely, very unlikely.
And Alan doesn't divulge what the grade is because apparently it wasn't important. Yeah. What do we think that he actually achieved?
The punchline here as well is that he says, after all of this build-up, suffice to say, I was the proud owner of two shiny A-levels.
Yeah. Yeah. And one of those is general studies, isn't it?
Yeah. So Alan goes to university, or East Anglia Polytechnic. I guess that's probably
safer to say he attends university than he goes there.
Also, from a very basic level of research, there is no East Anglia Polytechnic. It used to be called Anglia Polytechnic University, so it doesn't actually exist. So the only reason I discovered that is because I was looking to see if there are any famous alumni from East Anglia Polytechnic, and it doesn't actually exist, as far as I'm aware. I am awaiting a correction email on that.
No doubt.
So despite apparently hating his home, Alan opts to stay at home rather than living in the wormwood-infested squalor of university halls and decides to commute in from home using his rent money, in a canny move, that's his words, to ensure that he was beautifully shod. So apparently this meant that Alan became something of a mystery man about campus, which I think just means a bit of a loner that no one spoke to. He could be spotted at the back of lecture halls or ghosting through the student union with a glass of cider or shushing idiots in the library.
I wonder how many times he was spotted at the back of lecture halls.
Yeah, very much kind of self-proclaimed, I think, there. He goes on to talk about his dress code, which was thick zip-up cardigans. I mean, I'm instantly not on board with this. That just sounds uncomfortable. Flared brown corduroys.
Okay, I'm back on board.
Back on board. And it was the 80s. And skinny black pepper pop brogues.
70s, I have to correct you there. 74 was a crazy hazy time for Alan Partridge.
Good knowledge.
Yeah, he's read the book.
He's read the book. And he describes everyone else as just being long-haired Irish layabouts. I don't know why he had to bring Irishness into it, but he did.
I think for me, the quote that I love the most in this chapter, which really sums up Alan's university experience, because as we discussed, he's chosen to stay at home. He says, "I would have developed a pretty impressive booze habit and had full sex had it not been for the fact I was expected home for 6 to 6.30.
which is followed by a line I love. "You'll notice I said full sex. Oh, I dabbled all right."
Apparently, yeah, he had a nascent but powerful sexuality. He was no frigid.
Did quite a lot of kissing, some of it vigorous enough to chap lips, brackets mine and hers, unnecessary information.
Yep. Yeah, and he talks
about
all
that
these...
word count up again.
Yeah, he talks about all these kind of sexual encounters, but there was a passage that I pulled out that kind of like really touches on the reality of the situation where he says, "I'm happy to recall those eye-opening moments with me and Jemima sitting bollock naked on her bed with me exploring her body and my quivering hand while she coquettishly feigned indifference by reading album sleeves or smoking."
In reference to her, he also says, "I enjoyed erotic and informative afternoons with a student whose essays I was writing." So she basically is prepared to sit there nude and ignore him as long as he'll do all her work for her.
Well, does anyone know what coquettish actually means?
Vaguely, yeah.
I don't know. It basically means a flirt or a girl or woman who knows how to flatter or manipulate men.
There we go. Bang
also,
on the money.
Question to the group. Would you ever use the phrase bollock naked to describe a woman?
Very good point. Oh,
dear. Absolutely not. Yes. But again, that's the joke.
Yep.
So he's a cock certain man dishing out hard-hitting compliments such as... Again, like, this just, he says that he's dishing out these brilliant hard-hitting compliments, but this is one of the worst things I've ever heard, and I'm not sure if you would ever get away with saying it to a woman, but he describes a woman, Jen, as really busty. Goes on to add, one of the bustiest on campus.
And then qualifies it by saying, "You've got quite a long torso, but your legs aren't in the least bit thick. Believe me, if I didn't have lectures, I'd love to kiss your back from top to bottom and from side to side. Also, diagonally."
Diagonally!
But unfortunately, that relationship has to end because of an argument over armpit hair, which Alan has very ardent views on.
I think we know what side he falls on the armpit hair debate.
Well, I can tell you, if you're not sure, it says, "Whilst women should enjoy sexuality equally with men, if you're a lady and don't shave your pits, you look like a ruddy bloke." End of.
End of.
Awful.
No compromise. He kind of touches on about the reality of university life now and basically says it's pointless and useless, but I think that's probably just because he knows that he didn't really experience university
and he scraped 2 A-levels, so probably he wasn't quite ready for the university experience.
Citing that Wikipedia apparently has just made it redundant.
Do you think the fact that he doesn't like university and he scraped A-levels, he's obviously writing Jem's essays for her, do you think they're any good?
Probably not.
No, I sort of initially I thought she must be getting him to do the work because he's a SWAT and he's very good, but I don't think he's even that good.
There's a little section here just at the end of the chapter where I think the Venn diagram of Alan and Nick cross over.
Uh-oh.
Tell me more about this.
There's a section where he says, "That's why students and their incessant status quo bashing are so wrong. Challenging convention should be left to those who truly understand convention. And you can only understand convention if you stuck rigidly to it 99% of the time. That's basic." I just circled that section. Was like, that's Nick really, isn't it?
Hello. I'm pretty sure I've heard you say that verbatim at some point.
Would Nick also turn up to a house party and throw them a curveball with some steel I span and sing along at its and sing along to it at a steadily increasing volume?
Replace steel I span with Huey Lewis in the News and you've basically got Nick in a nutshell.
Further question, would Nick also turn up to a house party whilst getting Rory drunk on a Watney's Party 4? 4 pints of foaming beer in a can, or with Shaw's Lemonade, 6 pints of shandy. You'd go the shandy route, right?
Yeah, god yeah.
Who's Rory drunk?
Roaring drunk.
Rory drunk. If your name's Rory Drunk and you email in,
please get in touch.
I will send you my annotated copy of iPartridge. So we've suffered through Alan's university experiences, some extremely cruel bullying and parental cruelty.
Apparently.
Yep. His initial stark bollock naked exposure to a female lady's part. And we're about to meet Carol. But that's all we have time for this week. So please join us again next week on Monkey Tennis, the Alan Partridge fan podcast, when we will be delving into Alan and Carol's earliest dalliances. If you'd like to get in touch with us at all, it's thepartridgepod@gmail.com, at thepartridgepod on Twitter, facebook.com/thepartridgepod, and for some bizarre reason on Instagram, it's Monkey Tennis pod. From all of us at Monkey Tennis, we'll speak to you next week, all about Carol and beyond. Thanks and goodbye.
See ya.
Monkey Tennis? Smelly Alan Fartridge.
Linton Travel Tavern seemed an obvious choice.
Monkey Tennis?
At the BBC of all places. Be real.
Monkey Tennis?
Where's my assistant? I do not know.
Monkey Tennis?
I wish things had turned out differently, but I'm glad they didn't.
Monkey Tennis?
It will be called Alan's Show. I decided, and would be absolutely ace.
Monkey Tennis?
But needless to say, I had the last laugh.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.